Well, I just want to organize this, inviting me to the Perimeter Institute at Waterloo. You know, I'm no stranger to Waterloo. I actually worked here for a summer when I was an undergraduate, and I was a member of the Waterloo cricket team. In any case, I was an undergraduate at McGill in mathematics and physics. I became a mathematician, in fact, but I retained a fascination for quantum mechanics. And when Ernst Becker came to visit Cornell in the 60s, we started working together and continued working in Zurich for the next year. Right. So, let's see. Let me first of all, I want to just give a picture of Ernst Becker and his son. We were working then in Zurich, and he was a really wonderful man and a great friend of mine. Now, I want to start off by showing you a drawing of one of the great founders of quantum mechanics. And this drawing, let me see if I can come up with it. Yes. This is from the New Yorker. About your cat, Mr. Schrödinger, I have good news and bad news. So I like this picture a lot. Now, the work I'm going to talk about, in fact, had its origin in the old paper of 1967 with Specker, as you'll see. And right. So, yes. So what is this new key that I'm talking about? Well, the way it's usually formulated in Hilbert space, the way in which the concepts of state, observable, dynamics, and so on is done is strikingly different from what it is in classical mechanics. Classical mechanics, which, as Niels Bohr said, the formulation is just a mathematical, precise way of saying what we know intuitively. The notion of, for instance, the notion of state in classical mechanics, a mixed state, is simply a probability measure, which gives you the probability of future events as they happen. Now, quantum mechanics also gives you the probability of future events, but the state is not given by this probability. Instead, it's given by a complex probability amplitude. What is that? You take the probability and you take the square root of it, the irrational, if you like, mathematically, the irrational square root, and you throw in an imaginary element, the phase factor, a complex phase factor. So notice this, our theory, our best theory of the world, quantum mechanics, its concepts depend upon things that are both, if you like, irrational and imaginary. Complex probability amplitude. Now, I'd like to... I know. I need my glasses. Yes. So... what I'm going to do is to start off with the different, not with some ad hoc assumptions about what physics should look like, but I'm going to start with a general principle which will make clear the, not the striking differences between quantum mechanics and classical mechanics, but rather their great similarity. And the only difference will be there'll be one general change, and that will be on the, in the notion of what is a property of a system. And that we'll see that this one change will use this change to cover all every one of the concepts of quantum mechanics and of physics generally, to show how similar they are. Quantum mechanics is to not different, but similar to classical mechanics. So the basic idea is to look at the properties of systems. Now, classically, if you measure, let's say, the temperature of water, you assume what you're measuring is a property, the temperature that the system already has, right? We're measuring the intrinsic properties of the systems. And when we come to quantum mechanics, the situation is very different. If you want to measure the spin of a system in a particular direction by using, let's say, the Stern-Gerlach experiment, then no one now assumes that the property of spin in a particular direction is an intrinsic property of the system. Rather, it's the interaction with the magnetic field, which is inhomogeneous in that direction, that brings about, that yields the value of the spin in that direction. So, as opposed to these intrinsic properties that belong in classical mechanics, I'm going to talk about the extrinsic or relational properties that appear for a system as a result of its interaction with another system. So, and this is not in itself a new idea. Bohr, for instance, said, atomic physics are deprived of all meaning, such inherent attributes. So this is what I mean by intrinsic properties, as the idealization of classical physics would ascribe to such properties. So the first thing I'm going to do is to discuss mathematically how to distinguish between the intrinsic properties of a classical system with the extrinsic properties, or if you like, contextual properties of a quantum mechanical system. And what I'm going to do is show you, this is not an axiomatics that I'm doing, there'll be no axioms. I'll simply take the ordinary classical properties of a system, like observables, and symmetries and dynamics and so on, and show that the exactly the same properties that we give to the classical system when applied to extrinsic properties will yield the full quantum mechanics, including the Schrödinger equation in the non-relativistic case, and even the projection rule of von Neumann, which is added on usually as a new axiom. So let me start with this. So I want to now start off giving the mathematical difference of extrinsic versus intrinsic properties. And I'm going to start with a classical paper. By the way, what I'm talking about is done in detail with proofs in this paper I wrote 2 years ago, A Reconstruction of Quantum Mechanics in the Foundations of Physics in 2015. Now, I'm going to start off with Kolmogorov's classic book, Foundations of Theory of Probability in 1933. And he starts off with a probability measure, a theory based on a probability measure. And what he does is he starts off with an arbitrary experiment, and the theory will somehow give us the probabilities of the outcomes of these experiments. But we don't want just probabilities of whether a bunch of points on a detector system. We don't just want the probabilities of a given point on the detector. We may want to know whether it's this point or this point or this point, or whether it's not this point. And this way, we generate the Boolean algebra, which I won't bother to describe here for you as experts. The Boolean algebra of events, as he calls them, that are based on the outcomes. And this Boolean algebra, if we also allow for an infinite number of possible outcomes, we'll also add in countable unions and intersections, and that forms a Boolean sigma algebra that I've written here. And his whole theory is then based on a single axiom. A probability is simply a measure, a function from a sigma algebra to the unit 0, 1. And the single axiom says that it's additive on disjoint events. And we can always normalize it or put in a normalizing thing saying P of 1 equals 1. Okay, and that's the basis of all modern probability theory. I want to stress here that despite what some physicists think, exactly the same probability theory applies to quantum mechanics. And I just want to mention this thing that the Born's rule, which is what connects up the theory of quantum mechanics with actual experiments, tells us that if we have a system in, say, a pure state with a vector omega, then and you have an observable with, for simplicity, a discrete spectrum here, then if we write the spectral decomposition of the observable, then the probability that a measurement will give a value lambda k is the length squared of pk of omega, which is the projection of omega onto the image of the projection pk. And then, of course, the projection postulate tells us the state is then in this new state, the system is then in this new state. And out of this set of projections, we can form what I'll call the interaction algebra, which is a sigma algebra generated by the projections. And the Born rule then defines a probability, an ordinary Kolmogorov probability on this, on the interaction algebra generated by the PIs, so that the union of the PIs, the union over here, which is an arbitrary element, is then given as the sum. And that is an ordinary, classical, if you like, probability that also applies to quantum mechanics. Okay, and the result of the experiment then finally gives us also a truth value to the projections, saying that pk is true and the other pjs are false, and that gives us the truth value to the whole interaction algebra. And that's isomorphic to the interaction algebra, to the Kolmogorov sigma algebra that's generated by the actual outcomes, the events, as he calls this. Whether you talk about the probabilities of the actual PKs or the probabilities of the outcomes, they are isomorphic. You can talk about it macroscopically as points, or in the theory, in this case of quantum mechanics, given by the projections. Now, so far, there's no difference between classical mechanics and quantum mechanics. The difference comes in when we look at different experiments. So each different experiment will give us such a sigma algebra of outcomes, or isomorphically, a sigma algebra of properties. And for instance, as I say here, by varying the direction of the magnetic field in the Stern-Gerlach experiment, the same omega, the same state omega, will give us new sigma algebras depending upon how we rotate the magnetic field. And in this way, we get a family of sigma algebras that come out both in classical mechanics and in quantum mechanics. But for a classical system, the difference lies here in the following. When we measure the intrinsic properties of the systems, since they're intrinsic properties, when we measure any two properties, we can measure them either simultaneously or consecutively. We can do the measurement without disturbing either one. And so the union of these sigma algebras forms a single huge sigma algebra consisting of the actual properties that the system possesses. And the usual way to explain this in classical mechanics is to form a phase space omega and look at the subsets of this algebra. We don't take arbitrary subsets because then we'll get non-measurable sets mathematically which have no probability. We take a simple set of open sets in the phase space omega and then take the sigma algebra generated. It's usually called the Borel algebra. B, and we'll call that B omega. But the important thing is that the union of all these sigma algebras from different experiments gives us, the union gives us a single sigma algebra of possessed properties of the system. Now, when we come to quantum mechanics, it turns out, and this is the content of the old paper with Specker, it turns out there are some simple systems, quantum systems, consisting of a spin one system where you measure the squares of the spins, which commute in perpendicular directions, so we can measure them simultaneously. And one way to do this is to measure an observable like SX squared minus SY squared, which has this spectral decomposition. These are projections, and they're the spectral decomposition. And that gives us an eight-element Boolean algebra in this case. And we can measure this to find out which one, the sum of them must be, of the squares must be 2, so only one of them must be 0 and the other 2, 1. And this gives us the values of all these. And it turns out there are a small number of such observables, and we've recently reduced that number to 40. The original number was somewhat larger, but that's not too important. By having these 40 different orthogonal frames, we end up with interaction algebras. We cannot all be simultaneously embedded, or if you like, their union can't be embedded into a single such Boolean algebra. So it's clear then that in this case, if we include these quantum experiments, we cannot use a Boolean sigma algebra as the structure, the classical structure of a system. So we have to replace it by something different. And certainly that new structure has to include all the sigma algebras that arise in different experiments. So the minimal thing you can do is to simply take all those and take their union, which cannot be embedded in a single one, and we simply replace the sigma algebra of classical intrinsic properties by this minimal structure, which I'm going to call, which is the union of the sigma algebras that arise in different experiments from different observables, and we're going to call this union a Boolean, or just a sigma complex. You have to think of the complex as the union of all different sigma algebras that arise. In the classical case, it happens that this sigma complex already itself forms a sigma algebra. But in the general case of physics, and in particular of quantum mechanics, the old results show that this union cannot be a single sigma algebra. Okay, so let me make some remarks about this. So I'm going to talk about this in a very general case. We're going to simply take a bunch of sigma algebras and take their union and call that a sigma complex. And the way to think of it is to think of it as gluing together different Boolean or sigma algebras on their common sigma algebra that they may have between them. So for instance, in the case, the common one may just be trivial and may be just the 0, 1, but in some cases, as in the in the example I gave of the 40 sigma algebra of measuring Sx squared, Sy squared, and Se squared, if the two sigma algebra, eighth element sigma algebras, have Z in common, so I'm just rotating out my field about the Z-axis to get these sigma algebras, then in fact the common algebra is not just 0, 1, but it has Sc squared and its complement, 1 minus S squared, with this four-element Boolean algebra in common. And this is really the important thing, these compatible things that give the structure to the sigma complex. By the way, this is rather similar to what we already discussed, Sprecher and I, in the 67 paper. We called it there something, it's slightly different. We called it a partial Boolean algebra. But it's essentially the same idea. So I'm going to call it a sigma complex for various reasons now. And the important thing to realize about a sigma complex is that it's exactly this gluing together which is important. Because a Boolean algebra, certainly a finite Boolean algebra, has very little structure. The number of elements of a Boolean algebra completely determines the Boolean algebra. A finite Boolean algebra has 2 to the n elements, and that number completely determines the Boolean algebra. And the same thing is true even in the infinite case for quantum mechanics, where we're looking at complete atomic Boolean algebras, even the infinite case, it's completely determined by its number. So there's very little structure. The whole structure is determined by the way in which these sit together. And you can see that in the example that we gave in 1967. We gave a graph there, a sort of a graph that's based on this, and it's the graph completely determines the structure. And just by looking at the graph, you can see that there's no way of embedding this into a Boolean algebra or a sigma algebra, because there is every Boolean algebra has many homomorphisms into 0, 1, the simplest Boolean algebra, or another way to put it, of giving truth values to the elements. And that would give a way of giving truth values to the original sigma complex, but there isn't even a single such truth value evaluation. So that tells us that you cannot embed this into a single sigma algebra. So the sigma complex is completely given by its graph. Now, the one we're particularly interested in is obtained by starting with a complex Hilbert space and looking at the projections. They are the properties. And the sigma algebras are obtained by looking at any set of projections which is closed under countable intersections, if you like, of the images of the projections, or countable products, and the orthogonal complement, which for a projection is 1, for P forms 1 minus P, and any such set of projection which is closed in this way forms a Boolean sigma algebra. And now the family of all such Boolean sigma algebra forms then what I'll call the Boolean sigma complex Q of H. But again, the important thing is not the structure of the Hilbert space, which is rather complicated. It's a Cauchy complete and has an inner product. The sigma complex is just obtained by this very skeletal structure of the graph. By the way, I get the name sigma complex from something in algebraic topology. There they look at sigma, they look at simplicial complexes. And that's formed, you start with a simplex, and you glue together two simplices on subsimplices. And in this way, you get a simplicial complex. And this is not just an analogy, but there's a way of representing a Boolean algebra as a simplex, a very simple way of doing that. And then this the sigma complex really corresponds, those graphs really correspond to simplicial complexes. So it's really the very same thing. And it's just that skeletal structure that determines everything. Okay. So the first thing I want to do, I want to then do the following. I'm going to look at the various concepts like properties and observables and states and putting together two systems and so on and the dynamics. And the aim I'm going to have here is the following. I'll write down the classical definition of each of these concepts, which applies to the properties as they form a sigma algebra. And then I'll simply give exactly the same definition, but apply it now to a sigma complex, and then show that in the case of the sigma complex Q of H, that this gives us standard quantum mechanics, and we'll end up with a Schrödinger equation and, as I said, also the projection postulate will simply fall out of this from the classical concepts. So we'll see that as opposed to the usual way, strikingly different way of looking at it by Hilbert space, this will give a way of seeing the similarity it has to classical mechanics. The first thing I want to do is to see how do we get the Boolean sigma complex Q of H by starting with just a complex Q. We saw that the complex Q can be reduced, the possible complex, because Q is obtained by just starting from any set of sigma, either sigma complex is obtained by starting from any sigma set of sigma algebras. But if we throw in these 40 elements, that sigma complex, we throw out a lot of them by getting rid of those that are embeddable into a single sigma algebra. So the hope is that if you do enough experiments, you'll actually get down to something like Q of H. And that turns out to actually work. Let me give a very quick idea of how that works. So we're going to realize Q of H by means of interferometry. So I remind you that a Mach-Zehnder interferometer consists of two mirrors here, two 50-50 beam splitters, and I add in two phase shifters, shifting with a phase omega here and another one phi here, and this is done in short this way. So the incoming thing beams are 1 and 2, the outgoing ones are 1 prime and 2 prime, and this experiment, like any Kolmogorov, one done by Kolmogorov, will give us a Boolean algebra, in this case consisting of just 4 elements, and by putting in these phase shifters, the connection between the incoming and outcoming beams is given by this matrix. And the point here is that by varying phi and omega, how much the phase shifters shift, we're able to get all possible such four-element Boolean algebras, because this consists of all possible unitary matrices, and therefore it's easy to see that you get all possible self-adjoint two-dimensional operators, and therefore all possible such sigma algebras or Boolean algebras. Now, this gives the two-dimensional thing, which is rather trivial in this case, but there's a theorem in mathematics which says that if you have a unitary matrix of higher dimension, say on a Hilbert space of dimension n, then you can break it up into unitary matrices on two-dimensional subspaces of the n-dimensional one. And since putting it, if you compose two Mach-Zehnder interferometers, so the output of one is the input of the other, that corresponds to the product of the operators, the unitary operators. So we can, in this case, and here's an example from three dimensions, we can take, so we think of this as the unitary space given in three dimensions by three vectors, phi 1, phi 2, phi 3. So this gives you, in this case, phi 3, phi 2, this incoming thing. We put this to the outcoming thing here, and another one to this. And in this way, we get all possible three-dimensional unitary matrices, and therefore it follows we get all possible three-dimensional Boolean algebras of eight-element Boolean algebras. And in this way, we're able to realize all possible sigma complexes in three dimensions, and this generalizes to arbitrary dimensions. By the way, this idea is an adaptation of a paper by these four people called Experimental Realization of Any Discrete Unitary Operator. So I use this now to be able to get every single sigma complex of the form Q of H. So, by the way, I mentioned this. It is possible to also, I don't have time to go into this, the physicist Wetterlein has an interesting paper in which he shows how to do this, to axiomatically, starting from a partial Boolean algebra or sigma complex, get Q of H by putting down some axioms, which the axioms are of the form of saying if the structure is sufficiently symmetric, it has a large enough automorphism group, as I'll talk about later, then it must have the form Q of H. That's another way of getting to it. Okay. Now, I think I'll leave it at that. And now I'm going to start in looking at first, states, and show how classical states become quantum mechanical states by going from B of omega, the phase space, to Q of H. So a state classically, as we saw, is a probability measure on the sigma algebra B of omega. And now we go to some general theory, which is simply based, this will be our template for doing things generally. We'll go to a general theory, which is simply based on Q, where Q is a sigma complex. And we'll call a state a system with a sigma complex Q is a probability measure on Q, which simply means that its restriction to any sigma algebra B in Q is an ordinary Kolmogorov probability measure. So that's the way we'll always do things. We'll go from B of omega to a Q, and then we'll see, and this is the first theorem. The theorem tells us in the case of Q of H, there's a 1-1 correspondence between the states on Q of H, states in this sense, and density operators W on H, so that P of X is the trace of WX, right? And now this is the standard Born rule, the general Born rule for mixed states, right? So this simply comes out of simply saying that you have a probability measure. And it's easy then to see from this that we can get introduce pure and mixed states also by generalizing the classical one. So if we have some states, P1, P2, P3, on a Boolean sigma algebra, we can form a convex linear combination of them, a linear combination whose coefficients are fractions between 0 and 1, so that the sum adds up to 1. And such a linear combination gives us a new one. So that's what I've written here. And then, so they form what's called a convex set. And the extreme points of the convex set, which can't be written then as a non-trivial convex combination, are what are called extreme points. These are what we call the pure states. And in general theory, we can do exactly the same thing. Again, they form a convex set for the same reason. By forming a convex combination, we get a new such state. And in the classical case, the pure states have the trivial form that P is either equal to 1 or 0. There's always an omega in the phase space, which can give us, this is the complement of S, which gives us either 1 or 0. So these either have the probability 1 or probability 0. So in classical mechanics, we see there's a 1-1 correspondence between the pure states and the points of omega. So these are why, that's why that's called the phase or state space. Now in quantum mechanics, so we can do the same thing in the general case, which I haven't bothered to write down for Q. In the case of Q of H, the pure states are 1-to-1 correspondence not with points anymore, but with rank 1 projection operators, those whose image is a line, right? And these, which are then, of course, the rays of Hilbert space. And then the theorem that I mentioned before, so the rank 1 projection can be written as psi, the ray, in terms of the ray psi times psi. And then the theorem I mentioned before reduces to the ordinary Born's rule of taking the projection length squared. So the Born rule now comes out of simply the classical idea of a state as a probability, but the probability is on the sigma complex rather than the sigma algebra. So you notice here that a state is very similar to what it is in classical mechanics. It's given simply by giving the probabilities of things. You don't have to take the square root and put in a phase factor and worry about that. And we'll see what comes out of that is quite interesting. So I want to now discuss another point. So, and notice that the probabilities involved are simply the same as classical Kolmogorov probabilities. They satisfy the Kolmogorov equations. But now I want to come to a basic difference between quantum mechanics and classical mechanics. So, and that has to do with the notion of reduction or projection. So, before we get to this, let me explain what I'm going to do. So if we want to talk about state preparation, and there are many ways of doing this, but I'm going to look at the very simplest one, the sort of thing that's done in Feynman's lectures on physics. So let's suppose we have a system of spin 1, and whatever the original state is, I want to prepare it to be in a state of, let's say, spin given by spin S of z is equal to 0. Okay, I want to prepare it to be in this state so that I can talk about doing things to it. So one simple way to do this is the following. We set up a Stern-Gerlach experiment, but in place of a detector, where we would essentially destroy the particle, or at least the state of the particle, when it hits the detector. If I want to get spin 0 to come out and not be destroyed, I take the detector and I cut out a hole at the spin zeros. There are three spots it might have. I take the central spot, which is spin 0, I cut a hole through around there, but not enough to affect the other two spots. And I just simply, as I as I beam in different spin one systems, they'll either hit the top or the bottom and we'll forget about them, or they'll pass through. And those that pass through will have spin zero, S of z equals zero. And you can check that, because if you put a detector further up, you'll see it will always have probability one of hitting that central spot. But what Feynman does is not, he doesn't check that, he just says it's now a spin zero, S of z equals zero, and he can now, for instance, change the direction of the field for another Sternbach-Gerlach experiment in the direction S of x, for instance, and measure that. So that's the preparation of state and reduction by that preparation of state. It's very simple, similar to reduction in the measurement. Now, what is the, what, we want to now look at a classical counterpart to this. So that's very simple. I'm going to take, in place of quantum particles, I'm going to look at classical particles, for instance, bullets. So we're going to look at shooting bullets at a target. And if I shoot bullets at this target, there'll be a certain probability distribution of the bullets on the targets. And that probability distribution is giving you the state at that moment. That's what a state is. It gives you the probability measure on that moment. And that arises from an initial probability distribution or uncertainty at the plane of the gun. So that plane, that probability distribution, that mixed state, evolves through a classical equation, the Liouville equation for mixed states. This Liouville equation allows it to evolve to the final state. Now, I'm going to do the following, which is very similar to the spin thing. Halfway in between, I'm going to put a thick metal plate, which stops the bullets, but I'll put cut out a circle in the center somewhere, and I'll see what happens after I've cut out the circle. And what happens is the initial state evolves, as before, by Liouville's theorem, and then it'll either be stopped by the plate or it won't. And if it isn't, it has a new state, which now evolves again by Liouville's theorem to the final, very different state at the target. Now, what does classical mechanics tell us to do at this point? It says that the new state is obtained from the old state. The old state was given by a probability distribution P of x, and the new state is given by a probability distribution which is called P of x given y. And y is the event or property of having passed through the hole, not having hit the plate. So P of x given y is the new probability distribution, and that has a very simple formula. It's P of x and y, right, divided by P of y. That's conditional probability. And so that tells us that's the classical thing. This is the classical notion which we must now apply to the general sigma complex. So we start off with classical mechanics, and the state conditioned on y is P of x given y, which is P of x and y divided by P of y. And in general theory, we postulate a state on the sigma complex Q with y in Q, and always P of y mustn't equal zero. And the state conditioned on y is P of x given y is equal to P of x and y divided by P of y whenever x and y both lie in the same sigma algebra. But the point is, we also allow the possibility that x may not be in the same sigma algebra as y. Y happens, and then I can measure x. And given y, we can find out the probability of P of x given y. Now, there's nothing to say in this general theory that such a state exists, and if it exists, that it's unique. However, in the case of Q of x, it's a theorem that when Q is Q of h, every state, if I start with a state P of x and an element y with P of y naught, there exists a unique state, P of X given Y, which is conditioned on Y. So there exists a unique state. The point is, you're only told, just like in the case of the original notion of state, the conditioned state is only, you're only told what happens when X and Y are in the same Boolean algebra. But it's a theorem that you can extend this uniquely to a new state, P of X, Y, even when X and Y are not in the same sigma algebra. And this unique state, we know that if from the theorem before, that given a state on Q of H, P, there's a density operator that corresponds to it, then the new one, P of X given Y, is given by YWY divided by its trace. And that's the density operator that corresponds to the state of PX given Y. So this is a theorem which allows us to extend the notion of state to conditioned state, conditional states. And that's an important result because it tells us that we'll see that this notion is now quite different from the classical notion, that this extension when X and Y are not in the same sigma algebra. So this is the density operator is usually called the von Neumann-Luders projection rule. So it corresponds to, in the special case where W is simply given by a vector, or the projection of a vector, it gives you the projection onto X. And here it appears as the extrinsic counterpart to conditioning. So the von Neumann-Luders rule is a somewhat problematic rule, usually that's added onto quantum mechanics and deals with reduction or projection for such a theory. And here is simply the counterpart to ordinary conditionalization. And let me show you how it works then to show you how interference appears for the first time now when you have conditionalizing. So in the case, if the Y I'm looking at in P of X given Y, suppose Y has the form of a union of YIs which commute and they are disjoint, then whether it's classical mechanics or quantum mechanics, if you look at P of X given Y, it's easy to see that it's a linear combination of the P of X given YI, where the coefficients are just the probability of YI given Y. And this is a famous rule in classical probability called the law of total probability, or of law of alternatives. And in quantum mechanics, we just saw that P of X given Y is given by this formula. And if you work that out by throwing in the Y sigma YIs and then dividing it up into the case where the I, which equals the trace, this works out to the trace of YIWYJX, then if we divide it up into two parts, whether I equals J and I not J, the first part is the law of total probability, but here we also get an additional term which wasn't there in the classical case. And you notice that if the YIs actually commute with the J themselves, if the YIs actually happen, and you see, here we're looking at where Y happens, but the YIs may not have happened. The YIs may, and they may not compute with X. But if the YIs have happened, then and they commute with X, then I can bring the YI around to the front, and it commutes with X, and we get YI times YJ, which we know is zero, so the interference term vanishes. So, for instance, in the case of a two-slit experiment, we have two projection operators, Y1 and Y2, that correspond to projection at the two slits. Those are two that commute and have they have product zero. X is the projection at the distance screen at a some position, some little region. And the interference term happens because they don't commute, because in the interaction, which is just free flight, the yi's don't commute with the x. And therefore, we get the interference term. And you see, this is just what comes out of conditionalization, but applied now. The main thing that goes on now is precisely the fact that you have extrinsic properties. So a property y may actually occur, may be the case, even though y1 is equal to y1 join y2, but y1 and y2, in fact, don't commute with x and may not have happened because they have no value at all. So what is usually given as the sort of given intuitively in terms of way of the waves and the way they happen is here just comes out of conditionalization applied to sigma complexes. Okay, I think I'm going to skip observables. They're rather easy to deal with to give us the usual Hermitian operators. I want to get to the Schrödinger equation, and to do the Schrödinger equation, we know that that's given through a unitary evolution of the system. So we have to look at symmetries of the system, and for us, the symmetry classically it's given by a canonical transformation, which gives us an automorphism on the sigma algebra. And here we go, we're going to a symmetry on a sigma complex is simply an automorphism on Q, and that's a 1-1 on 2 transformation of Q, which preserves the operation on each sigma algebra. So exactly what we would expect. Only on the sigma algebra, that's what a symmetry or automorphism is. And I shall need, since I'm also looking at the change of maps or states, that such a symmetry on the properties also defines a symmetry changer P to P sigma, which is given by P sigma of X is P of sigma of X. In a natural way. So that also changes the states. Remember, the states are simply probability measures. And by the way, that preserves convexity. That's also a convexity-preserving map. Now, in the case of quantum mechanics, where Q equals Q of H, there's a theorem now that tells us that there's a 1-1 correspondence between the symmetries of Q of H and unitary or possibly anti-unitary operators such as sigma of x is equal to ux u inverse. Every such unitary or anti-unitary operator defines such a symmetry on Q of h, but and that's easy. The hard part is the converse. The theorem tells us that there is always such a unitary or anti-unitary such as sigma x equals that. And now we can, from there, also define a density. If P of X, if P, the state, corresponds to a density operator W, then P sub sigma, which we define this way, is then the trace of this applied to X, W given the U X U inverse. And if we move the U inverse to the front, we see that P of sigma then corresponds to U inverse WU. So that tells me how the states change. And now the dynamics follows very quickly. So in the case of the dynamical evolution of a system, we have to consider systems that are invariant under time translation. That's part of the general idea of using symmetries to define operators, in this case the Hamiltonian. So there's no absolute time, only time differences. And so if I have the difference from time zero to time t, if it's given by a symmetry given by sigma t from q to q, then since only time differences matter, we see that the sigma of t to plus t prime is simply the composition of sigma of t with sigma of t prime, right? If I go from zero to t and t to t prime, it's like going from zero to t prime. And if I add on, as is also done in the usual unitary thing, if by saying p of sigma of t is a continuous function of t, in other words, small times give you small changes in the probability, right? If I put those two together, I get a continuous one-parameter curve in the automorphism group of Q. The automorphism group consists of the group of all automorphisms of Q of H under composition. And we can then see in this case that anti-unitary properties don't occur, because U of T is U of T of a half square because of this condition here. And that tells us it must always be unitary, because the square of an anti-unitary is unitary. And now we're essentially through, because if W of T is the density operator that corresponds to this change, then by a well-known theorem, U of T must be written in this form in terms of the infinitesimal generator H. And so W of T by this has this form. And if you differentiate, you get the Schrödinger equation for mixed states, which reduces to the ordinary Schrödinger equation in the case of a pure state. And let me finish with one last point, which I won't belabor here, but in a certain sense was the most difficult part for me to do, because for a long time I didn't believe it was true. And that is, how do you put two systems together? How do you put two systems together? Classically, if you put two systems together, then the phase spaces, what you do is, the phase spaces are obtained by taking the Cartesian or direct product of the phase spaces. And in quantum mechanics, very different. You're putting together the tensor product of the two unitary spaces. So how do we get, how do we do this? In classical mechanics, see, we don't want to work with the phase space. We want to work with its dual, namely B of omega, namely the sigma algebra. And there's a general theorem, Stone's duality theorem, which tells you more or less how to go from the space to the sigma algebra of properties. And it's a theorem of classical mechanics that the direct product of the spaces is isomorphic. This Boolean algebra, sigma algebra, is isomorphic to what's called the direct sum of the two sigma algebras. Now, sometimes it's called the free product or the co-product in categorical terms. Anyway, that's a well-known concept, which is to be found in Koppelberg's book. In the general theory, Q, we have to define that. See, we now know what to do. We have to look at the direct sum of the sigma complexes. And the direct sum is, again, the natural thing. It's I'm not making it up. It's what has to happen. You always simply go by what is what corresponds to the classical case. We simply take the sigma complex consisting of all the sigma algebras obtained by taking, and the subalgebras obtained by taking the direct sums of the sigma algebras. So taking simply all those direct sums. And it then turns out to be a theorem that the direct sum here simply corresponds to the tensor product. So the tensor product arises naturally in this case, even though it's a much, much bigger space in this case. And in a way, this is what, as Feynman was saying 60 years ago, it's this fact that you have a tensor product, this much larger space whose dimensions are the product rather than the sum, that allows for the possibility of quantum computers. So let me just, I don't think I'll go any further on. Let me just finish up by going back to my original point. So in the original paper with Sprecher, we show that there's no real hope of getting back to classical mechanics. Our example showed that classical mechanics can't really do the same thing as quantum mechanics. But in this paper, I'm trying to show the great similarity of quantum mechanics with classical mechanics once we admit to the possibility of going to extrinsic from intrinsic properties, the idea of contextuality. So there's no mechanism for going back. So let me just finish with a small story. I started with a cat, with a cartoon of Schrödinger's cat. Let me finish with a story of a dog. So this fellow in New York City says to a friend, he says, look, you're a technical guy. Explain to me, I turn on the knob of this radio, I hear someone singing, and I'm told it's a soprano singing in San Francisco, 3,000 miles away. How is it possible for that voice to appear in New York City, 3,000 miles away? The fellow says to him, it's a very simple idea. There's nothing to it. Imagine you have an immense dog, a long Dachshund, who's got his tail in San Francisco, and its head is here in New York. Somebody pinches the tail, and it barks in New York City. A radio is exactly the same thing, except for the dog. So quantum mechanics is exactly what classical mechanics is, except for the dog.
Because Claisen's theorem only holds for
which theorem?
The Claisen's theorem.
Claisen's theorem.
Yeah. Only holds dimension d bigger equal to 3. Right. So like the probability measure, like a conditional probability, at that point dimension d equal to 2, there are some probability measure which is not conformed to Bohm rule.
Which is not?
Not conformed to Bohm rule.
Conformable?
Come from the Bohm rule.
So it doesn't follow the Bohm rule?
Yeah, in dimension equal to 2.
In dimension 2? Yes, I should have said, this goes from dimension 3 onwards. I didn't mention the dimension.
So like this kind of conditional probability and composite theorem, can we still consider these kind of things in dimension 2?
In dimension 2?
Yes.
I'm interested in the general case.
Yeah.
If you want to look at dimension 2, the old paper with Sprecher actually gave, von Neumann claimed to have a proof of, in his book, he claimed to have a proof of non-existence of hidden variables. If you look at that proof, it's already, if it were right, proper proof would already apply in dimension 2. And so we took the trouble actually of actually getting a classical model in dimension 2. In dimension 2, you can actually form a classical model that gives all the right probabilities. So in dimension 2, things are, in that sense, if you consider it by itself, you really could do, if everything exists in dimension 2, you could go back to classical mechanics. But you want to look at the general case. So it's true, from dimension, if you were only looking at dimension 2, that none of this would apply. But I want to look at the general case.
So you mentioned in the beginning, you started with the Kolmogorov probability theory,
yeah.
And you cast quantum mechanics as a kind of generalization of that.
Well, Kolmogorov is not a generalization. It's an example of Kolmogorov. It, just probability itself, the Born rule is an example of Kolmogorov probability. It obeys the Kolmogorov axiom that it's additive on disjoint events. That's just as much true in quantum mechanics as classical mechanics. It only differs when you start introducing the idea of conditional probability. There, that's where it really varies. And I want to mention one thing about that. You see, this idea of reduction or projection is usually taken to be a very problematic thing in quantum mechanics. You have a state given by a vector, and all of a sudden, it projects down to some particular state, a new state, very suddenly. But from the point of view we're looking at here, it's perfectly understandable, because if this projection is nothing but conditionalization, it occurs just as much in classical mechanics as in quantum mechanics, and all that the world is doing is a new piece of information, a new fact. P of X given Y, Y has happened, so there's a new piece, a new fact that has occurred, a new event has occurred. So if a state is nothing but a probability distribution, in this case, a probability distribution on a sigma complex, but in the classical case, it happens to be a sigma algebra. But that doesn't matter. In both cases, this sudden change is perfectly understandable. A new fact gives you new probabilities. It's only because the usual way of talking about quantum mechanics in terms of complex states that makes it look, and you expect a complex state to evolve in a unitary way, and all of a sudden it projects down in a non-unitary way, that you worry about it. But if you think of about it this way, as simply an ordinary probability, but a probability on all different sigma algebras in the sigma complex, the fact that a new fact occurs gives you a sudden change in probability is just as much true in classical mechanics as in quantum mechanics, and it becomes non-problematic, in my opinion.
One last question from Matt.
So is there any technical difference between the definition of a Boolean sigma complex and a partial Boolean algebra, or are they just...
Yes, there are some differences. The main difference is, first of all, aside from the fact that it's sigma algebras instead of Boolean algebra, that's not important. A partial Boolean algebra has a conditional condition, which I didn't need anymore for these purposes. And it sort of says that if you have a bunch of... if any pair are compatible, then you can get a compatibility on the whole set at once. But that's a condition that's sort of hard to understand from an experimental viewpoint, although you can do that. But we worried about that and felt we had to put it in, but I don't need it anymore. So for this purpose, I had this more general notion. But it's really, in essence, the same idea. And so it was already there with Strecker 50 years ago.
So we want to leave a bit of time still for coffee, so let's postpone any further questions and you can discuss them during the break. Let's both thank Simon for his talk, but also very much for joining us on this momentous 50th anniversary of his great theorem and the birth of contextuality. Thank you.